is CoDiscovery. Hello and welcome to this episode of CoDiscovery with me, Abigail Acton. As the 22nd of March is the United Nations World Water Day, this episode of CoDiscovery is on water, its quality and security of supply. We will travel to the high Himalayas and delve into the secret lives of freshwater snails. What can new technology tell us about the impact of climate change on the water cycle of the Himalayas? And what are the impacts throughout the vast areas that depend on the runoff? What can new approaches in arable farming in China teach us? And how do we make agriculture climate smart? Is precision farming the key? And if so, how can we make that work? There are more of us living in cities and greater demand is being placed on water supplies. A fast, accurate and simple way to check levels of pollution in wastewater is to be welcomed. Ecotoxicology is a fast-growing field. So what can freshwater snails, leeches and shrimp tell us about the levels of micropollutants in water? I'm delighted to say that we have some answers. Welcome to my three guests, whose work has been supported by the EU's Horizon 2020 programme. Walter Immersel is Professor of Mountain Hydrology at the University of Utrecht, where he is leading various projects at the cutting edge of climate change, glaciology, and hydrology. He is particularly interested in the interaction between the topography of the Himalayas and its impact on the water cycle. Hi, Walter.
Hi.
Research scientist at the Institute for Sustainable Agriculture at the Spanish Council for Scientific Research, Jose Gomez combines a background in agronomy and soil science. He is particularly interested in bridging the gap between research and the practical use of innovations in farming. Welcome, Jose.
Hi.
Didier Nuzeret is the CEO of Viewpoint, a French company that has been involved in environmental research and animal behavior analysis for 30 years. He is interested in video tracking the behaviours of certain invertebrates, known as biomonitoring, to check pollution levels in wastewater.
Hi, I'm very pleased to be with you today.
And we're happy to have you. Walter, I'm going to turn to you. You have been researching the hydrology of the Himalayas since 2002. What features make this area of such interest to you, and what was your project CAT setting out to do?
Thanks. That's a very good question. No, Himalayas... Many people think of the Himalaya as being just one mountain range in Asia, but in fact, the region is very diverse. So it goes from the almost the wettest place on Earth on the south side of the Himalaya to the dry mountain deserts of the Tibetan Plateau. We have the largest amount of glaciers in this region. So also, you know, the way the atmosphere interacts with the glaciers and the water cycle is highly diverse. So that's what we try to do in CAT to kind of unravel the water cycle, to see what the climate change impacts are, and to detect how the regional differences are.
Right. Okay. And what initially attracted you to this area? Because it's your involvement with the Himalayas has been going on for quite a long time. How did that start?
Yeah. No, I get this question quite often. I mean, I'm a guy from the lowest country in the world, which is completely flat and generally below the sea level. So why are you going to the Himalaya? It's a bit of a coincidence. So I went there with my wife on a honeymoon for 6 months. So we hiked all the tracks in the Himalaya, and we were completely amazed by the landscape. And then the perfect job came along, and from one thing came another. And yeah, I ended up researching glaciers and mountains and mountain weather for at least a decade already.
Fantastic. Absolutely. That's great. I love it when people have personal connections with the subjects that really excite them. So tell me more about the work that you've been doing under the CAT project. How did you do your analysis and what did you find? And I guess also perhaps what were you looking for?
Yeah, what we were looking, I mean, we were dealing a lot with the issue of scale. When we started out, the amount of scientific studies is quite limited there. And if they were there, they were focused on single glaciers. And I was always amazed. It's not about single glaciers. So if you look at the greater scheme of things, the glaciers may play only a limited role. So I wanted to understand the entire water cycle. So how does it work in the water cycle at high altitude? So there are other processes which are important. So there's snow melt, there is snow sublimation. There's, of course, the glaciers. There are extreme gradients in rain and snowfall. So I try to take a holistic view on the high altitude water cycle. And that is what we focused on. And we started at a very small scale, but we also zoomed out to look at the entire river basins and also look at the link. How important is that water that comes from the mountains for the downstream regions?
Okay. You say you started at a small scale and then you zoomed out to look at the whole kind of river basins and the runoff area. When you say you started at small scale, tell me a little bit more about sort of what you were actually looking at.
No, we pinpointed a number of key processes. An example is, for example, many glaciers in the Himalaya are covered by debris. So there's this big layer of debris which comes from erosion from the headwalls. And if there's a thick layer of debris, that basically protects the ice from melt. But if it's a thin layer, it means it darkens the surface and it accelerates the melt. You can compare it with wearing a black t-shirt in summer. You feel warmer. So it's the same process. But still, we found that those debris-covered glacier tongues, they melt as fast as their clean ice twins. So we used drones and we mapped those glacier surfaces with very high level of detail. And we repeated that every half year. Then when you look at the change, you can very accurately see where that melt is occurring. So we found, for example, that you have all kinds of ponds on the glacier surfaces and ice cliffs. And these kind of features are sort of the catalyst of melt on this type of glacier. So that was quite new, because if you use satellite images, you can't see that because they don't have enough detail. So that's one example.
So greater resolution, as it were. Uh-huh. And what sort of equipment did you use? You mentioned you used drones. What other kind of technology did you use?
Yeah, we used a lot of weather stations, all kinds of weather stations. So we were, I think, one of the first groups who really measured snowfall and rainfall between 5,000 and 6,000 meters of altitude. So those are extreme conditions. So you also need very rugged equipment that can last for a long time. We also faced, to be honest, a lot of problems. So with the power supply, if it's minus 20, then batteries, they don't like that very much. And there's avalanches that have destroyed weather stations. So, but overall, after 5 years, we ended up with quite some interesting findings and really cool data sets.
Yeah, that sounds absolutely fascinating. And not your sort of run-of-the-mill problems facing people normally who are trying to observe topography like this. Yeah, very interesting. Thank you. And can you tell us a bit more about why it matters? And I'm interested in knowing a little bit more about what your findings have disproved.
Yeah, okay. I think it's quite obvious. If you add up all the people who live in the river basins which surround high mountain Asia and the Himalayas, Karakoram, Tibetan Plateau, then it's about 25% of the global population. So any change happening to the hydrology of the region has potentially a very large impact. And about a decade ago, there was an IPCC report was published, and one of the big messages there was the glaciers in the Himalaya will disappear and Asia's rivers will most likely run dry. But what we showed is that it's actually the opposite. The glaciers will be there for quite a long time. They melt faster, and that glacial melt will only decline towards the end of the century. And at the same time, most of the climate models, they predict an increase in precipitation because the hydrological cycle accelerates. So overall, what we predict with our models is an increase in water availability. So it's not shortage of water we have to worry about, but it's basically excess of water and extreme precipitation.
Causing flooding downstream, you mean, for example?
Flooding, exactly, yeah. And the glaciers are retreating, and what remains is, you know, rocky areas and rocky surfaces. So all the rain that falls immediately ends up in the river. So the river flow becomes much more unpredictable.
Uh-huh.
So that's the main challenge to deal with. And you see that every year, the big disasters are happening due to extreme rainfall, due to avalanches, due to landslides, and it's all triggered by extreme rainfall.
Right. Okay, that's interesting. And as you said, the retreating glaciers. Excellent. Thank you very much for telling us about that. It's super. Can I see if anybody would like to ask anything or anyone has any observations? Yeah, Didier.
Yeah, I am interested in knowing, you know, I will tell you about micropollutants later on, but I'm wondering if you have had the opportunity to know what is the composition of the ice in the mountain, or if the rain over there is containing micropollutants, because in Europe, for example, this is the case. So is it the case over there?
Yeah, that's a very good question. No, I've never really focused on water quality. The most thing that we have been doing is we did geochemical analysis and isotope analysis to detect what is actually the source of water. But really looking at pollutants, we've not done that. I know that even, I think, at 6,000 or 7,000 meters, they've detected microplastics also in the ice. But yeah, I'm interested in it, but I've never really researched it myself.
Sounds like the next phase for another project.
Yeah, exactly. Good idea. Maybe we can do something together.
See what's actually going on there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Any other questions or observations, Jose?
I has been really interested in what you said about that your model predictions predict an increase in precipitation in your area. And it's something that mesmerizes us in the Mediterranean because some of the model predicts more precipitation, but we think that we observe a slight decline. And I wonder, are you setting experimental records to reduce the uncertainty in the predictions, or how, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The climate models, as you know, are very uncertain. So one model predicts an increase of 10%. The next one predicts a decrease of 10%. Yeah. So we started with this whole monitoring of high altitude rain and snowfall. But yeah, we only started like 6 or 7 years ago. So it's too early to detect any trends.
But you keep having that.
Yeah, we keep going. We try to add funding, find new projects to make that record as long as possible, because it's essential to validate those super uncertain models.
Yeah,
absolutely. Thank you very much. Jose, I am actually going to turn to you because in a way you're sort of covering part of the same terrain as Walter here. The SHUI project is working to improve how we deal with water scarcity in European and Chinese cropping systems, and it's looking at how precision farming can help. What's holding us back when it comes to a more sustainable use of water and protecting soil health, Jose?
Well, there are like two blocks. One is the technology, and we still have part of the world, or even inside our country, where all the technology that we have for precision farming and particularly for precision irrigation is not already in place. So there is a scope there, and that's a piece. But the second piece that is very clear, that the policy of the right of the water rights and how water is allocated as a society is the other pillar. So we need to work in both.
Right. Okay. And tell me a little bit more about the SHUI project itself, because you're bringing together organizations in Europe and in China. Tell me a little bit more about how that is working.
Well, it's basically starting like a group of friends. Basically, we are scientists in Europe, but we need to be honest. We are a group of scientists. We like to work on long-term experiments in relating agriculture and runoff and water use. And we saw an opportunity to link with Chinese colleagues.
Right.
So that's basically how it started. And how has been the handling with COVID-19 and restriction for travel? Well, we can say we have got a mixed success. We keep it running until the end, but when we stop it having personal interaction, we really suffer from that.
Yeah, that's impacted on us all, but I suppose particularly if you're working in close collaboration, obviously, indeed, and maybe cross-culturally as well, it maybe is easier directly than via Zoom and things like that.
Yeah, you need time. I mean, even within the same culture, you need time in science to develop trust.
Uh-huh.
And we were working also with farmers and stakeholders. So that's the piece of the project that we couldn't complete it as good as we could.
Yeah, well, that's for next time. So can I ask you a little bit more about your feeling about knowledge silos? Because I know one of the things that SHUI as a project really wanted to do was to spread data so that it became accessible to different groups. And I know that the preoccupation of the idea of knowledge sort of in pockets and not actually being accessible was something the project tried to address.
Yeah, I think we did a decent job on that. We created a database that is, most of the experiments are fully open, of very long-term experiments, like 20 years. We talked before about uncertainty in the results, like 20 years on conservation agriculture in cereal crops in Austria, or 50 years in a long-term experiment in Austria, or 20 years in tree crops in Spain. So the idea is that we invest a lot of time and money in generating the data, but sometimes we don't make a proper use of them. And what is very interesting in science is that actually different people looking at the same data or gathering the same data see something that the original researcher didn't catch it. So I think we put a lot of efforts in that, and it's one of the parts of the project that we are really happy.
Okay. I'm just curious to know what other tools you developed, actually.
There was this intercultural thing between who is the owner of the data, that it's very different in Europe and in China. So we need to deal with that. And it's one of the points that we could have made more progress if we had had more personal relationships. I think everyone wanted to have a broad look of very long-term experiments in Europe in agriculture, and soil conservation can have a look.
Excellent. So that's the background with regards to the mechanics of what you were doing, but what's the practical application? So can you tell me a little bit about some of the tools that you've developed that can actually help on the ground?
So one of them that we developed is a common situation in many countries like Spain is that you have a drought, you have different tree crops, and you need to decide how to allocate a limiting amount of water to do the minimum damage to the yields or the trees. So one of the teams developed a model is called TreeWatt that is fully available on the web to help to make these decisions to farmers or to policymakers you're working in a big irrigated district. Or we also developed another tool. You know, when we talk about precision farming, we may talk about many different things. For instance, if you want to irrigate, you want to fractionate your field in different areas where you can irrigate with different amounts, or if you are using fertilizer, you fractionate. So we developed, again, another tool that is fully available on the web to help you to divide, if you have a big field, to help you to divide your field in two or three. You cannot have 20.
No.
I mean, two or three, so you have an optimum to divide.
And that's what you mean by fracturate?
Yeah.
You mean divide up?
To divide it, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's another tool of we developed. And we also developed that first was a best man. Another thing that happens in all this issue of conservation farming and deficit irrigation is that because it comes from the academic world, we have different language for the same technologies or different technologies with the same language, what creates havoc among stakeholders and policymakers. So basically, we develop a joint best management practice handbook with an APP to help farmers.
Can I stop you for a second? What do you mean by an APP, please?
An APP is a tool for Android where you can check it in your phone.
Okay. So basically, it's like a common dictionary.
Yeah, it's a common dictionary. It's something a little bit more, but it's a common dictionary made by the Chinese European colleagues. So it's now in Chinese, English, and Spanish that can be in another language I want to do. So there is a very easy decision rules to pinpoint if you are a farmer, which might be the best strategy for your condition. It's not the final word, but it can help you to decide. You have the ability, you have a large farm with an ability to have investment, and your main focus is on water. It directs you to some technologies. If you are a small farmer and you are in very steep slope, you know that your more rational choice of best technology will be another. So we developed that. That one of the more cooperative things in the whole project. So that's now available in the web as PDF and as an APP can be downloaded from the digital CSIC repository.
That sounds fascinating, really interesting. And I know that you're very motivated to see new ideas and innovations actually be practically used in the field. So this is why you're making the data available and understandable to various users. So thank you very much for that. Do we have any observations or comments to make to José? Yes, Didier.
Yeah, I understand what José is doing. As a viewpoint, we have developed a tool that is dedicated to plant phenotyping. So looking for seeds that can grow correctly with a scarcity of water. And we also deal with people in China because in our historical market, we have plenty of cooperation in China. So I can understand what he's doing and how the people there are. You need to have someone who you can fit with in order to do good science. But I think the Chinese people are very efficient.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Super. Well, in fact, Didier, I'm going to turn to you now. So that was timely. Your team at Viewpoint, the company behind the ToxMate project, Didier, has focused on behavioral analysis of animals such as zebrafish for neuroscience research. Now you've moved into measuring ecotoxology with a focus on water pollution. So can you tell us more about the species you're using?
In fact, we came to a cooperation with INRAE in France, which is a public research center dedicated to agronomy and ecotoxicology. And we have had the idea to use the people living in the water to ask them whether the quality of the water is good. And after several years of research, we came to the conclusion that we found three organisms that are very interesting, which are a small shrimp, which is a gammaris, then a water snail, which is called a radix, and a leech. And simply looking at their behavior, we can detect macropollutants in the water in a matter of minutes. So that's quite new, but that's a solution that is really interesting because at the moment we say that you can have between 200,000 and 300,000 compounds in the water. So physicochemical analysis is no sense. Asking live animal is quite good.
Right, because there's just so many things to look for. So can you tell me a little bit about how this actually works in practice? Multiple tanks, how does this work?
So this is a system very simple. In fact, this is just like an American fridge. You can put it at the exhaust of a wastewater treatment plant, either urban or industrial. And we pump continuously the water. We filter a little bit the water. We keep the temperature steady. And we add oxygen, and then we send this water in real time to some tanks where we have our three spaces in different tanks. And we have cameras looking at them in real time and that are analyzing their behavior. And in 2 to 10 minutes, they can tell you whether there are some micropollutants in the water.
That's fascinating. And what sort of things are you testing for? What sort of pollutants are revealed?
More or less, we're sensitive to whatever things that stress the animals. So it can be heavy metals, it can be pesticides, it can be biocides, it can be whatever is disturbing for the normal life of those species.
And so you can observe that something is happening and that they are reacting, which is indicative of the fact that there are pollutants present.
Exactly.
But then what happens afterwards? So what the I guess it's mainly water companies, they get alerted, and what can they do?
Yeah, they can be alerted in real time. So either they have a way to act, let's say, to store the water for a moment, or they can start an advanced treatment, which is able to remove micropollutants. So we can more or less trigger those processes. And we can also make them work when it's necessary. I mean, we have, for example, ozonation or activated carbon that can be used to remove the micropollutants. But those are very expensive processes. So if you can trigger them when it's necessary, then you can save some money.
Yeah. So basically, it's much more efficient. And as you say, rapid. Are water companies showing interest? Is it just for water companies or other organizations? And what's the reaction out there?
Let's say at the moment we are working with big names that supply tools for such problems, but more and more we have municipalities that are dealing directly with their water. So we have to prove them that we are efficient, and we have to help them in introducing this technology and having it used for not only wastewater, but it's so sensitive that we can also use it for drinking water.
Didier, this all sounds very interesting. It's quite a different direction from the usual work of your company. What do you hope that ToxMake will achieve, and why did you go in this direction?
Let's say our historical market is for neuroscience. We have been working with scientists, with researchers for more than 30 years, and every day we're looking for new ideas. They ask us whether we can add them in doing new tests, different things. And here, we change our mind because we went to a different field of application. We have our knowledge of analyzing the behavior, and we say, what can we do? We have been working on health. We have been working on food. And now water was something that we can perhaps address. And we have had this idea to ask to the organism living in the water if they can help us.
Actually, ask those directly concerned. Indeed. Thank you very much. That's very interesting. Do we have any questions or observations for Didier? Everybody does. I'll start with Walter. Walter?
Yeah, no, it's very fascinating. And I was wondering, can you also, because I can imagine you only have a number of fixed behaviors, right, of a snail. If he's stressed or not, maybe he gets sleepy or hyperactive. Or but can you also make a link between the change in behavior and the type of pollution that is there?
Exactly. You're right. This is exactly what we are doing at the moment. And in fact, we have do three different species, and we can have a signature that is linked to the type of micropollutant. So the next step will be to tell you what type of micropollutant is in the water, depending on how all those three species are responding.
Ah, fascinating.
isn't it? It's a great idea. And also, I love the fact that it avoids the overuse of purification systems when, in fact, they're actually perhaps not needed. Jose, you wanted to say something.
Yes, out of curiosity, because you are moving in the direction of testing the technology with natural water courses, right? Like rivers. Have you tried, and what have you seen? I'm curious about how this biological indicator may react in our rivers. Have you tried that, and what is the quality of...
We use it as a warning station, because we have plenty of places where drinking water is based on pumping the water from a river. So we use that at the pumping place, so we can check that there is no micropollutants in the water, or we can stop pumping in order to avoid polluting the process with micropollutants.
I'm fascinated because you have a broader range. I mean, you have the possibility of testing more substances than the one that are usually used for water quality.
Exactly, exactly.
And have you been in the situation that the standard indicators tell you the company that the water was okay?
Plenty of times.
And
plenty of times. Everything okay. is green, and all our spaces are stating no.
Okay. Okay, it's fantastic, yeah.
Isn't it? Because it's something that just, you know, there's no kind of paperwork that they can shuffle in the background. They just are happy or they're not happy. Yeah, excellent. Thank you so much. Well, listen, thanks all of you. That was really very interesting. And it's vital work that you're all doing. And I love the way that we've gone from something really enormous like the whole Himalayan mountain range to the reaction of a water snail via Jose's incredibly important work building bridges between Europe and China and precision agriculture. Thank you so very much for your time.
That was my pleasure.
Yeah, my pleasure too. Yeah, it was great.
Mine too.
Good. There you go. So we're all happy.
Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye. If you've enjoyed this podcast and are interested in the latest scientific research coming out of the EU, take a look at the 23 previous episodes available on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, or find us on Anchor. Follow to stay abreast of what's coming up. Are you curious about what other EU projects are doing in the area of water and food security, climate change, and water recycling? The Cordis website will give you an insight into the results of projects funded by the Horizon 2020 programme that are working in this area. The website has articles and interviews that explore the results of research being conducted in a very broad range of domains and subjects, from wind farms to wheat farming. There's something there for you. Maybe you're involved in a project or would like to apply for funding. Check out what others are doing in your domain. So, come and see the research that's revealing what makes our world tick. We're always happy to hear from you. Drop us a line, editorial@cordis.europa.eu. Until next time.